Welcome to our second podcast. This is Bob Panos with American Digital, Vice President of Sales and Professional Services. And with me today, I have Brian Bouchon, one of our top account executives, and a friend of American Digital, Rob Hanlon. And I'd like to hand it over to Brian real quick. He can give a quick intro, and then we'll go to Rob.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Brian Bouchon, been with American Digital for almost 20 years. So it's been a good run. And evolving, ever evolving in this industry we're in. So appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian, for coming. Rob?
Hi, I'm Rob Hanlon. Thank you for having me today. It's really fun to be here. It's good to see friends and see professionals that we've done a lot of work together. Some of my background, I've spent about half of my career in consulting in various large firms, boutique firms, had my own company for a while. And then a client asked me to join them on the other side of the desk, and I became a CIO. And I actually declined it. I said, no, thanks. I don't want to do that. One is, and this was back a ways, I said, I don't really know how to be a CIO. And secondly, I don't particularly like CIOs. It's a tagline I've said often, but it kind of holds true in a lot of ways. Because I think sometimes we create an environment for ourselves that does us very little service in the market. But I spent most of my time at Treehouse Foods as their senior vice president and CIO, and have recently transitioned to become president and CEO of an early stage fintech startup called CyberMoney. And it's exciting. It's new. It's early, early stage, totally different than sitting in a CIO seat at a big publicly traded corporation. But it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. So I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Awesome. Well, we'll hit, you know, certainly mostly on the IT topic. Maybe we'll get into some of the fintech stuff later. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, from my perspective, and thank you again, Rob, for coming in. It's great to have somebody with your varied experience come in and talk to us today. And we've had conversations in the past, and you know, you've always had a great, I thought, pulse on kind of the IT marketplace and just the, you know, how the whole operation works is from both sides, right? Like you said, consulting and being on the end user side. So from our perspective, that's a unique kind of skill set. You don't see that a lot. So really, I wanted to start off today with kind of just talking about some of the pressures a CIO faces. You know, from your view at a high level, you know, having been in that role for a long time, what are some of the pressures you face, you know, that maybe the outsider wouldn't necessarily know?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it somewhat sets the tone for our conversation in that a lot of it has to do with the environment you're working in, because the first place everyone goes to is stability and cost. Uptime, am I servicing what I need to service at the right cost that I need to service it at? And those are just table stakes for a CIO. But the problem is that's not where it stops. And that's where a lot of people stop. And I think that's what differentiates a lot of CIOs is they stop at that uptime, cost, you know, service level layer. But there's so much more than that. You hear CIOs say a lot of times, boy, I want a seat at the table, or I have a seat at the table, or how do I get a seat at the table? Well, getting a seat at the table is not about that first layer. That's just expected. A seat at the table, and this gets to the pressures, is being a business person who happens to know technology, but you're a business person first. Just like marketing, you're a marketing expert, but you're a business person first. You're a CFO. Well, you're a finance and accounting person, but you're a business person first. And I think sometimes we as CIOs forget that theme a little bit. And what happens is when you talk about pressures on a CIO, big consulting firms, in both technology and business and strategy firms, put out a lot of content related to thought leadership that CIOs should already be thinking about. And what happens is those messages go around straight to your board of directors and go around straight to your the C-suite. And you're not bringing that message to the table. An outsider is, right? And so right. If you're a business person, you're thinking about those things already. You're staying ahead of that. And so I think keeping a pulse on the current content that's out there, the current ideas that are out there, is really critical. And there's a lot of pressure to make sure you're able to dialogue about those things. And you may not fundamentally believe in those things. I think digitization is a very interesting concept. What is it really? I think if you go back in time, you think about e-business, you think about Y2K, right? I was in the seat in those days, right?
Yep.
And a CIO who operates at that first layer of cost and uptime starts talking about those issues in context of cost and uptime. That's not the point. The point is talking about those issues in the context of business. What does it mean to our business today?
Do you seek out information, you know, those trends, or do you wait for them to come to you from some of these consulting companies, or do you do both? How do you get that information?
Yeah, having spent time in consulting, both in the large firms and small firms, it starts with relationship. And so I work hard to maintain relationships with those folks, just like I work hard to maintain a relationship with American Digital.
Yeah.
Right? You connected me to other partners, other providers who have thought leadership as you have thought leadership. And an ecosystem is all built on relationship. And so it's really important that relationship be part of the skill set, one of those arrows in the quiver, so to speak, of a CIO. You know, we need to understand how to build relationships because that yields insights and content and ideas. And now you're partnering with firms to co-create ideas that can impact your business because you're talking about in the context of business. And so I definitely spent quite a bit of time seeking those relationships out, co-creating ideas and content. Going back to this key to partnership, sometimes I needed to help them out and sometimes they helped me out. And that ability to help each other is really critical in building those relationships and getting those ideas. And all of a sudden now you become a CIO who's a little bit of a thought leader and you're talking the same language that your board is hearing, that your C-suite is hearing. You're now in the middle of that and sometimes you're ahead of it. And that's really critical to that next layer, that next operating level beyond cost and uptime.
And it's interesting, you talk about relationship, right? That's actually Danny, our VP of marketing, and I were talking earlier. That's going to be our next podcast, is going to be to discuss the key to relationship, you know, relationship selling from our perspective and, you know, how important that is. I mean, it's not just transactional selling, right? Building those long-term relationships, which you may not get something out of right away, right? It may be down the road, but you cultivate them, right? And you have people come in, talk to you, and then it may, 2 years later, you know, they might be able to help you, but that's the key of relationship. And I'll say this, Brian, you know, who's here today is one of our best.
Yes, he is.
At relationship selling. So I'll ask you, Brian, real quick. I know you weren't ready for a question. Sorry. But, you know, from that standpoint, how do you, you know, view the relationship selling, you know, kind of contrast that real quick, you know, versus, you know, doing a transactional kind of relationship, right? I mean, they're two different things and they take different investment. And I know, you know, you've done a lot of that with Rob and others. And, you know, I'd be interested just to hear real quick what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think when I started out, I like people. It's important for me to have a connection, enjoy who I'm going to be spending time with. I think the thing that's interesting about relationship, I'll tie it into American Digital. It takes time to build a relationship. A relationship is about the long game. And if you don't have a company that you're working for that allows you to do that, you can't build those relationships. I mean, we look at the manufacturers. These guys are getting rotated in and out every 2 years and they lose their accounts. So there's none of that. So, you know,
you're talking about the sales reps.
The sales reps and how those companies treat their sales reps. So this is a kind of a luxury I think we have here at American Digital, is to be able to do that. And that's how you learn. You know, the other thing I'll say about relationship, not only in business, but I think I've noticed this with on the personal side, the relationship becomes a relationship when there's an issue and there's friction and you get through that.
It can. That's right. I agree with
right?
you, Brian.
I mean, we had that with you.
We did.
You, right. Yeah. I'm thinking about you. I'm thinking about some of my personal relationships where you kind of wonder, well, are we going to get through this or is this the end? And then, you know, you got two people that are reasonable and value each other, then you get through it and then you come out on the other side and you're stronger. So I say that from a personal perspective and also from working with Rob and some of the things that we've done. So that's my two cents on relationship.
I appreciate that. It's a good perspective. And it's the, you know, it's the reason you're here, I think, today, Rob, right? I mean, it's the relationship long-term, you know, cultivated over a long period of time, not always, you know, necessarily associated with doing business right away, but it's just, you know, like I said, cultivating it.
Strong partnerships make us better, right? And not just with American Digital, but if I could go think about my key relationships I had as a CIO, they were all based on this same principle. It takes time to build trust, and you go through some bumps and you figure them out, and you're transparent with each other, but respectful. And sometimes I need something, sometimes you need something, and that plays out over years, and that creates such a strong bond. And all of a sudden now we're creating solutions that are well beyond what any of us could have imagined. When we were at Treehouse, we started out with nothing. You know, we were a small company with nothing. And we had to build our environments from scratch. And so we started to build those relationships. And then all of a sudden you start to connect your partners and they start to co-create solutions for you as well. So it's not just a one-on-one effect. You can start to create this exponential partner network that really drives value beyond what you could even possibly imagine or created on your own. And that's really powerful. And if you come at it with the relationship first, you are always better off, in my opinion. And when you start with cost first, or sign the PO first, or whatever you want to call it, you have no chance of building that network that it can be so powerful.
True words have never been said before. That's we live by that motto. American Digital is really, we don't look at the short term. We look at the long term. Brian made that point clear. That is, kind of how we operate. And some people, that's not in their DNA. Right, they're very transactional, but I think we are enabled by the culture at our company. It enables us to offer that type of relationship to our customers because, unlike a manufacturer, we're not measured every single quarter, every month. What are your numbers? It's not like a boiler room situation, right? We are. I want to use the word artists. We're allowed to be able to paint the relationship with more of a brush strokes, right?
But I would say the onus is on the CIO though to create that, right? If we're not willing to participate that way, it doesn't work. And no matter how great you are.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
If you're coming in for a beating and a cost reduction, where's that relationship?
There isn't. And we've been there before.
So use the term relationship and partnership. I think about some of the work we've done where we've spent 9 months once or twice a week with somebody working on a solution. That's all up front. That's us doing work, understanding that because we have a partnership, because we have a relationship, that things will happen down the road. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but those two words, partnership, yeah. It's easy to say partnership and relationship because it sounds like everyone's holding hands. There's an investment in that. There's a huge investment. Yes. We've made a huge, huge person, people,
time.
Investment, right? Time. It's all about time.
So you bring up a great point is that people think you're sacrificing business quality and sound decision-making for relationship. That's not the case. Relationship makes those things stronger. Guaranteed, right? I just guarantee. I've seen it too many times. Remember I said I don't particularly like CIOs and that somewhat holds true? Let me give you two examples. This is when I was a young guy coming up through the consulting ranks. The first thing, I was at a client, massive client. I won't say who they are, obviously, but I had a cube across from the CIO's office, kind of buried two layers back. And all he did all day was people would come into his office, a lot of times partners, and he would just beat them senseless. I mean, just, what are you guys doing? I'm paying too much money for this. And then he'd send them on their way. He'd pull out a bottle of Pepto-Bismol, drink it right out of the bottle, a couple of swigs, put it back in his desk, and call the next one in. All freaking day long. And I'm like, that is a horrible, horrible job. My second experience, I was a new kind of partner in this small boutique firm, and we were a large corporation. And the CIO would call me into his office, and I'm going in for my weekly beating because that's what it was. It was you're not doing enough. The price is too high. What are you guys doing? I mean, and it didn't matter what you did. That's what was going to happen. And so I thought that was what CIOs do. They operate at the quality, cost, service level. And it couldn't have been a bigger turnoff to a profession in my life. But as I slowly learned from working with good CIOs, that this concept of relationship really holds true.
Okay. So that sparked something in my head. You always use the word or term political capital. Yeah. I remember that, right?
That's right.
And the more political capital you get within the organization, the more freedom you have to not have to be that guy that has to browbeat vendors or consulting firms, right? So was that when you got to Treehouse as an example, how did you earn that political capital over time? Was it, did you start off browbeating or did you come in, do your own thing? Tell me how that
Yeah. First thing is you start behaving like a business person first. And now you have to get your execution layer in order. If it's not, at Treehouse, we were very good. We were low cost. We were executing well. Our service levels were good. The likability was good of the group, good reputation. And so, we were operating at that service level. We needed to go to the business level. And so the first thing is solving business. What are the pain points of businesses going through? Getting to know your peers, getting to know your C-suite, you know, just spending time with them. At the company I was a CIO at before Treehouse, we were global and we had most of our businesses outside the US. And in this case, there was a heavy contingent in the European geography, and they just were leery of a US guy coming in to tell them how it was going to be. And that's not why I was going there. I was going there to get to know them, right? So I'd walk their facilities. I'd go meet their customers. I'd meet their people, go to their product development group and learn what they do and just connect. That's all I was doing, was creating connections. That trust is how you start to build political capital, right? They trust you. There's a likability factor. I honestly think we just miss that. We miss the idea of likable, because likable is weak, and it's just not. That is such a bad analogy, but that's what people believe, that if you're likable and nice, that you're weak. And that I tell people, don't confuse my niceness for weakness, because that's not the case. There are times when I can't be that way, right? Because we have an issue that we have to fix together, but we will get through it together. And so political capital is built by earning trust, by solving business problems and talking like a business person, and by bringing a network that's bigger than yourself and your team with your partners to the table to solve even bigger problems or come up with new ideas. Now, all of a sudden, you're more than just a technologist. You are a business leader solving business problems, because fundamentally, why do we invest in technology? It's to drive business value. But I think of it this way. For every dollar I am spending on a piece of technology, I'm not spending it on the roof of a plant, trade promotion and consumer product business, trade promotion for the customer, building new customers, developing a new product. I'm taking a dollar away from those things and putting it towards technology. So I better be getting value for that. But me and my team, that's how we would frame it. We'd frame it on every dollar we spend on technology, we are not spending on a business connection. So how do we enable that? How do we make that even better and stronger? And it starts to change the tone and the frame and the context by which you make IT decisions. And when your whole team is thinking that way, all of a sudden now there's power, and your team starts to become attractive and get recruited into other areas of the business, which is a fantastic result. As opposed to stopping it, why not create evangelists that then get pulled into other functional areas that then can talk the IT exciting story and spread the word. So there's this kind of, you know, not only relationship, but evangelism thing, which I think is really important. And that's how you build political capital, because all of a sudden now, hey, Rob's group is where we develop leaders. Rob's group is where some really cool ideas come from. Rob is where we go and talk in a transparent way about our vulnerabilities and where we might have problems. And I can trust him to co-create that together and not go blabbing and use that against me. So political capital has somewhat of a negative tone, because it's also when we say political, right?
Yeah.
But it's really trust. And it's built on so many different facets or so many different ways. And it really is relationship based.
Respect.
That's a great point, Brian. I think that's a fantastic word.
Yeah. I mean, it's a term I've heard you use a lot. And, you know, I think from a partner perspective, working with you and Treehouse, we've always tried, you know, to top of mind to help you create more political capital, right? More trust within your business. Because if we let you down, right, your political capital goes down.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And that's why I think sometimes CIOs miss the boat, because that is, to me, what a business CIO is really thinking about, right? How do I solve business problems? And they'll say they solve business problems. Like, I'm going to put a system in to create workflow for whatever, pick something, sure, right? But that's not really the problem you're trying to solve. The problem you're trying to solve is, how do I get more return for every dollar I spend in product development? Not in the workflow I put in to help with product development. So anyway.
Yeah, no. You said something about, you know, building a relationship within the C-suite, right? So from your perspective, does reporting structure matter for a CIO? You know, we always ask the question, you know, from our side, you know, the selling side is, oh, hey, does that CIO report into the CEO or does he or she report into a CFO, right? Because that makes it, are they going to be focused on price and browbeat you, or are they going to be autonomous? Does that matter?
So this goes back to one of the pressures on CIOs today, right? Because the marketplace will tell you 100% it matters. It absolutely matters, right? If you report to the CFO, you're going to be focused on cost. If you report to the COO, you're going to be focused on service level. If you report to the CEO, you're going to be focused on strategic matters. Well, I understand where that context comes from and that it's a rational thought. It's just not right. That's the problem. And so you have this whole marketplace that is selling into your company. And I'm not talking about just IT. I'm talking about all services, all areas. And, you know, they don't want to talk to you because, you know, you're going to be the one to focus on cost, right? Oh, don't get the CIO involved. He's going to slow that down. And so that, like I said, that's just fundamentally not right. What matters is the person you're working for, what type of a leader are they? Do they lead with cost? Is that what they're focused on? Do they lead with innovation? Maybe. Do they lead with strategic and relationships? It depends what they focus on. So I've worked with many CFOs, right? And so I reported to the CFO at Treehouse, and I worked for three. Each of them were different. One was, and I'm not going to say their names, obviously, you can guess, but one was a true business leader. He was focused 100% on the dynamics of the business. Now, he was an expert of finance and accounting and what that means, and Wall Street loved him. The analysts loved him. But within Treehouse, he was viewed as an operations guy, a business person, right? He understood it. I worked for one that was, I called him a CFO. You know, he was accounting, finance, you know, he didn't, cost was really important, but he understood long-term where we were headed strategically. But cost was, so I led lead with cost there, but then there's, what about the longer term? Then I worked for a third one that was focused on innovation. What are we doing differently? How do we do things differently from our competition to differentiate ourselves? Each one was different in their own way, neither good nor bad, just different. And your agility as a CIO is to figure out what is that all about. Most CEOs don't want a CIO reporting to them. And I'll tell you, CIOs created that environment themselves. If you go back to the Y2K days, right? And if, for those of us that were around back then, right? Yeah. CIOs created a narrative where the world was going to fall apart. Better hoard your water, go get your gas, and build your bunker, because all hell is going to break loose when we flip over to 1-1-2000. And the massive amount of investment that was made, I mean, it's staggering. Now, some of it justified, no doubt about it. But I will tell you, there was irrational spending going on, in my opinion, back in those days, on things, whether you're motivating ERP with, you know, they called it ERP in a box. For $100,000, we're going to put a new ERP system in. Oh, no freaking way is that going to happen, right? But that's what was being sold. It was crazy time. And what happened was CIOs lost credibility when that event hit. And things were relatively calm. When you woke up the next morning and by your TV worked, oh, I could go get cash out of the ATM, I could fill my car with gas, credibility instantaneously disappeared. And so CIOs have created an environment where they lead with technology. And we've, in my opinion, we have never recovered from Y2K days. And that goes to e-business. It goes to digital today.
When you say haven't recovered, you mean reputationally?
Reputationally. Okay. And I'm going back to why do CEOs don't want CIOs to report to them? They're going to talk to me about technology stuff, not about business problems. I don't need a person on my team telling me technology stuff that, I can't probably understand it, and two, is not additive to the issues I'm dealing with today as a business leader. So empathy, right? Putting yourself in the shoes of the person you're working for or the C-suite, because everyone has different issues they're dealing with day to day. No one cares about your technology. They care about the issues they're having and how can technology help them. And so I think CIOs do themselves a disservice by not leading with business pain points and how do we solve those? Because sometimes it's not a technology answer. Sometimes it's a process answer. Sometimes it's a contractual answer. Sometimes it's a policy answer. We do this because sometimes it's just how we've always done it, right? And this kind of, I can't think of the right word, but any of the point being is no one challenges norms because it's just groupthink. So a lot of times it's not technology. And so as a CIO, you need to think through it that way and then come back to the technology.
Right, right. And that's, yeah, that's where we come in, right? We hopefully help out with good technologies, but you're right. You got the business, you know, what is going to benefit the business has to be the first thought, regardless of who you report to, I guess, and, you know, in the organization and how you do it. Because at the end of the day, if there's not an ROI, a benefit, how can you justify it to anyone within the organization?
Right. So I'll give you an example.
Yes,
right? A real example today that's going on. Hyperscalers versus, let's say, owned infrastructure.
Sure,
right?
Yeah,
Non-hyperscaler,
yes.
Right? I'll call it traditional infrastructure. It's crazy what's going on right now. And my answer is this. Neither one is right or wrong. It depends on your business environment and what you're trying to accomplish, because both have upsides and both have challenges. And you have, in my opinion, you need to decide what's right for your business in the context of your business. Going to a hyperscaler was all the rage a year or two ago, right? How do I get to hyperscale? How do I get it? Pick some AWS, Google, Azure, go down the list, right? Whoever it is. HP has their own, a green.
It's on-prem. Yeah. Theirs is on-premises.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Misunderstood.
Yeah. But it's consuming as a cloud.
Right.
Yeah.
So I can configure my traditional infrastructure and consume it as a cloud, to your point, right? Or I can go to a traditional hyperscaler. So let's ask the question, why? What are you trying to accomplish? Are you trying to accomplish cost? Are you trying to accomplish uptime? Are you trying to accomplish faster provisioning, right?
Agility.
Is it agility? What is it? And until you have the conversation about that, hyperscaler versus traditional on-prem doesn't really matter.
So let me ask you a question. So I've had that conversation with you. I've had the conversation with just about every IT leader.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the big term is cloud first, right? We're a cloud first organization.
Another pressure on CIOs, by the way.
So how do you, probably not an answer, but it's like, what I wonder is, how can you get senior level management to have a rational conversation? How can you get them from this, I've talked about it in the club, or I read something and this is what we need to do. How can you roll that back, calm people down, and you just listed like three or four rational questions to ask them. Is that possible?
So,
and I know it's. I feel like I can't really do it.
So,
because you're struggling with it.
It's a relationship question, right? And it's go back to political capital. No, for the most part, and I know this is not 100% accurate, but a C-suite person doesn't really care about, are you traditional on-prem or cloud? What has happened? Remember, we talked earlier in the conversation about this kind of information or consulting firms or whomever, the board,
influencers.
The influencers. Call me influencers. Right? The influencers getting to your C-suite and your board, and all of a sudden this theme starts to emerge. I'm like, where the heck did that come from? Mm-hmm. Why is so and so talking to me about cloud when their iPhone isn't actually working very well, right?
Right.
So it's very interesting, but that's a true pressure because it happens all the time. You could talk about cybersecurity, you can talk about cloud first, you can talk about offshore, whatever the concept is, it's the same principle where there's been influencers go around that create a narrative and you're not sure where that narrative came from or the value of it. So going back to Brian's point, you need to bring it back to what are we fundamentally trying to accomplish? Because there's a lot of truth in some of those things. I'm not saying the narratives are wrong, but let's put it in the context of what our business strategy is and what we're trying to accomplish as a company. And companies go through seasons. Sometimes they're growing. Sometimes they're contracting. Sometimes they need to cut costs to accomplish something. They go through seasons, and your messaging needs to be agile and your capabilities agile to make that happen.
So
great point.
And it is. What intrigues me, though, is how the hyperscalers have really infiltrated all parts of the business. Because you're, you know, as a CIO, you were, sure, I'm sure they're coming to you, but they're also going to the BU people. You know, the guys that can just swipe the credit card and get what they need. Because, you know, it probably wasn't true at Treehouse, but maybe their IT department is slow at provisioning. So they go right to Azure. They tell their guys, hey, just go get some resources from, you know, one of the hyperscalers and swipe that credit card. And then you got the CEO telling you, oh, I was at this thing and, you know, oh, why aren't we looking at the cloud? I mean, is that happening a lot?
All the time.
Okay.
All the time. You know, and I learned a little something about 5-6 years ago. So I'm not necessarily a young guy, right? I'm in my 50s.
You look.
Thank you very much. Just got to keep the hair in, right? That's the key thing.
I know.
But you can always learn, obviously, right? And so I learned something that That is absolutely true that sometimes you get circumvented, right? Because cloud, really multi-tenant, especially in the software game, allows that to happen pretty quickly. And it's usually spot solutions. They're not enterprise. It's spot solutions, right? And it's a low cost of entry, 10 grand to enable this thing. Like, that's awesome. Well, how the heck are we going to sync data? Go to my inventory of CIO stresses, right, on operations. We got to figure that out. So, you know, the easy answer is, well, shut it down. And that's how we started. So what would happen is contracts. So we had a policy that spend couldn't happen. It didn't matter, frankly, right? That shouldn't be an issue, but it doesn't matter. And I'm not saying it was a treehouse, but it happens all the time everywhere. And so you establish a relationship with the law department because that's where all contracts go to be signed. And the law department will say, hey, there's one that came through. We need you to review this. And that's how you can find out about these things. Now, do you shut them down or not? And so in my response, and what I learned was, you don't shut them down. You use it to start a dialogue about the problem you're trying to solve and how can we solve that problem. And the answer may be in the short term, yeah, let's do this. That makes a lot of sense because I can't solve that problem right now with all of their other priorities, but you can with this, let's say this multi-tenant solution, sure, right? Especially in a point solution. But know that when we do get to it, we're going to assess not what you're using today, but we're going to assess what's right for the enterprise, you know, at a longer term. But we may need to move away from that. Now, sometimes you plant a seed that you can't uproot, and that's okay. But if you start off by trying to shut things down, all of a sudden your reputation is not one of partnership. It's one of shutting things down. And you need to really protect that partnership CYA. Idea. I mean, you start to play the service level cost CIO game, and that never wins. It doesn't. Control. Yeah,
that's my decision. I can only.
Power. Power grab, territory. That's mine. That's not your. That doesn't work.
To me, that, you know, somebody's doing that, that's a symptom of something else, something that's wrong, right? That there's a reason.
Right. You're not meeting their need in some way.
I mean, it's almost like, oh, wow, why did they do that? Why, you know, and so starting the dialogue and not saying, you know, hey, you can't do that, right? That's an IT thing, right? That's mine. You know, if you come out of that approach, like you said, that's hurts your political.
You doing capital. That makes you a very secure person because it's the insecure people that.
Well, that's
what Bob said. Yeah, what are you exactly doing? What right. Have I done? I gotta protect myself.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. There is a confidence to that, right? So I'm gonna tell a little anecdote that I have a close group of IT leaders that I've built long term relationships with, and we use this analogy a lot, and it's the run down the hill mentality, right? And so you ever see someone run down a sand dune hill and they're a little bit out of control, their arms are flailing and their pace is all over, and they eventually stumble and fall down, right? We are all so worried about and trying to solve a problem so fast that we run down the hill and we stumble and fall because that just seems like the right thing to do. As opposed to standing back and say, why are we running down the hill? Why don't we just walk down the hill and figure this out together? And too many people are in such a hurry to scratch an itch or to solve a problem or to, you know, control something. And that's confidence. That's all it is confidence. And you need to be confident enough in your experience and what you've done. And if you focus on the business to know, I'm probably going to be right. And if not, we're going to figure this out together versus I'm right, you're wrong, my territory, your territory. It's just, it's staggering how often that happens. So anyway, that's my little analogy.
No, it is. And thank you for that. You know, again, this whole hyperscaler in the way, you know, it's all, it's just an example of you can't control everything.
Right.
And to be a flexible leader, to understand that there's going to be trends. Like we were talking earlier in the conversation about, you know, how do you get your information on new trends? Well, this is one that's kind of in some ways being forced upon you by insiders in the organization, right? Oh, you know, I'm swiping a credit card and grabbing some resources. It's really fast. It's really cool. You know, the world is changing. We see that on our side too, right? On the sales side.
I think I've had numerous conversations with customers that say, well, Microsoft through Azure has built in $150,000 worth of credits for me to go to the cloud. You can't turn that down. Now, granted, it's probably free like a puppy and not free like a beer, but I run into that all the time. It's like, what do you do?
But that's transactional.
It also, I think it creates a conflict of interest. I mean,
They're giving you cash to do something?
Well, yeah, the rationale changes.
The incentive.
How can I justify foregoing this much credit for something that we think we're going to want to do, and they're just
There is a total cost of ownership conversation, no doubt about it, right? But sometimes agility and responsiveness trumps total cost of ownership. You know, there's another common conversation we have about, is a single solution better or a best of breed solution better, right? And I've had that conversation many times. Yeah. I have a personal belief that a single solution is better. But I will tell you, it sometimes that leads to a lack of agility and speed at which you can do some things. It just does. But the trade-off is I get so much benefit for that. So much benefit. And I get clean data. I got integrations that work. I don't have to worry about them. I get common context, common user interface. That's so important. But sometimes that loses too.
Well, I'll say, you know, the best example, in my view, Office 365. I mean, 15, 20 years ago, we were selling, you know, a lot of hardware for Exchange environments, right? I mean, some companies had some really large and complex email and collaboration environments. And, you know, that was great business, right? But then a great point solution came along, right? With Office 365. And we use it internally here. That's a perfect example where I think it works well. You know, you've got your contacts, you've got your email, you've got your collaboration with Teams, and you know, there's a lot of value in that product. And that's a perfect example, I think, where, hey, I can get a user up and running right away. I just click and add them, and, you know, it's a no-brainer. Whereas with ERP, that's a little bit more complex. And you know, there's a lot of different applications that connect. It's not as simple as a, you know, Office 365 or even a Salesforce for Salesforce automation or things like that. The points, there's some great ones out there. So that's how do you decide? Oh, do I put my ERP in the cloud? Because it's so easy and it's so great.
So just a couple of thoughts. One is Office productivity, you know, because 365, I hear what you're saying, right? Well, there's Google out there too, Google Suite, G Suite. And we looked at that trade-off. What do we want to do? Because we had a major acquisition that almost doubled the size of the company. One of the chunks was O365, and the other one was traditional on-prem Microsoft. And we had a decision point. Do we want to flip or not? And we said, what about Google? I'm like, well, that's very interesting, very compelling. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about it. And there are lots of pros and cons on both sides of that.
Sure.
Cost, agility, flexibility, adoption, personal adoption. How much change can people handle? And, you know, it doesn't come down to cost. It comes down to how much change can people handle? Are we willing to change? So the people side of it is so important. Why do ERP projects fail? Why is the landscape littered? I mean, literally just bodies everywhere of out of control ERP projects that didn't work. It has nothing to do with the product. It has everything to do with the people, willingness to change, willing to adopt common process, willing to accept trade-offs, pros and cons. And so it's the same thing for Google versus O365. Honestly, it's the same thing for hyperscaler versus on-prem. It comes down to people and your willingness and ability to change and adapt. And fundamentally, companies aren't agile enough to adapt or change. It just is. And you can put programs in place, and that helps. It does help. It is somewhat of something to grease the skids with, but the amount of time you have to spend helping people change usually is the make or break. Secondly, once people change, they always leak back to the old way to do things. And so one of the things we did at Treehouse was we were an SAP shop. We put SAP in. Great change management, great training, great adoption. Everything's great. Go back a year later, we'd find processes all of a sudden aren't being followed. There's things that are not closed out in the system just because you didn't need to ignore it. And it wasn't to be divisive or to be, you know, not follow rules. Just the natural state of business is so fast, you go back to what you knew. You have this memory that recoils back to what you, kind of like a spring returning back to its natural state, right? Yeah. And so we had to go back and do health checks. And SAP, it could be any system, any function, whatever it is. I think this idea of going back and doing health checks, whatever it is so critical to the success of a system, not just short term, but long term, going back to total cost of ownership. Because this leakage, this gradual erosion from standard will cost your company well beyond what you could possibly imagine. Data clarity, process, wait times, things stuck in queue. And I'm talking about business things.
Yes.
It's staggering. So this health check is a tool that can be applied to anything, ERP, office productivity, good on the list, that is critical to the success long term and ultimately your total cost of ownership.
That is what we are trying to help customers with, is navigate, you know, these, what we navigate ourselves. Do how much do we invest in, you know, working with hyperscalers versus on-prem? And, you know, it's kind of eye-opening to see it on both sides. You know, everybody's struggling.
So
you're trying to go through this journey, you know, together as business partners and to, you know, with, and try to figure out the best path, right? What, what fits the need? What were you going to say, Brian?
No, yes, you talked about the strewn bodies of failed ERPs.
Yeah.
So I happen to know that you integrated a ERP with tremendous success.
Very proud of that.
Leadership.
Yeah.
That's a leadership thing. I think it'd be cool somewhere along the line to have maybe another podcast with some of your other leaders, that you've got relationships with, to talk about the success and how to do a complex ERP. Because one other thing, I'm talking to a guy right now. We're talking to some people right now. They have an ERP. They have SAP and they want to get rid of it. And I'm thinking to myself, what if you could do it with a team of people that could execute so cleanly, precisely, efficiently, that now maybe it's something you don't have to rip and pull out, but something you can really leverage. And that goes into, I know that you've got people that know how to negotiate contracts and all the things that probably people overlook. So anyway, maybe another time.
Brian, first of all, I appreciate the recognition. And you know me well enough. You guys both know me well enough. That has not very little to do with me and has everything to do with my team. I am was blessed to have one of the most incredible teams anyone could possibly have. My success is 100% due to them. My team, they exhibit a lot of the things we're talking about, right? Each differently. Each of us are different, right? Each of us have our prickliness that makes us somewhat prickly, but each of us have a lot of fantastic ideas. When you put it together, it does incredible stuff. And so team building, and I don't mean team building like frisbees and coffee mugs and let's go out and have a picnic.
Yeah.
Team building like picking the right people, putting them in the right situation, setting them up for success, removing barriers, and sometimes putting them in a room and knocking their heads together and forcing them to get along. All those things is what makes a great team. And I have it's the best team anyone could ever have, right? We're all quirky in our own way. We have a good time. We know how to laugh. We know how to laugh at ourselves. We know how to get serious and figure things out. When I see them being recruited into other areas, it's a source of pride for me because job well done, right? They've developed into true IT business people who solve business problems, which to me, they're CIOs of the future. And it's exciting for me.
That, you know, having a great team, we have it too, right? We have business partners that, you know, fill gaps in areas that we don't have the expertise in. And, you know, together you go after, you know, some business problem. It's almost like you're going to a toolbox, right? And you got, I know a tool I need for this, you know, opportunity. Yeah. I bring in this partner because we know what we do really well. And I think, you know, in the data center, we do a great job, but there's, you know, some aspects of, you know, enterprise applications and things of that nature that aren't in our wheelhouse, but in our partners and having that team, you know, is integral into your success. I mean, can't say that enough.
Just one theme that just popped in my head. We're talking about CIOs a little bit and what differentiates kind of layer one CIOs and other CIOs, right?
Okay.
This idea of being vulnerable with your team. What do I mean by that?
Yeah, I was just going to ask that question.
So look, sometimes I'm wrong. Sometimes I don't let them talk. I don't let them finish sentences because I'm so busy getting my own sentences out. But they need to have the confidence to look at me and go, hey, knock it off. Let me finish. You can only do that in an environment where you're vulnerable and you're willing to participate in a way that allows people to speak what they need to speak. And if you're not vulnerable to your team, and I'm not saying weak. I'm saying empathetic, humble. Right, we talk about confidence. The other side of confidence is humility, right? Confident humility, those two things should always be linked together, in my opinion, because nobody likes a super confident person because basically they're not nice people, right? I can use a different word, but I'm going to stay away from that. We'll keep it a family podcast. And there are people who are just humble all the time and never get their ideas out, and they need to be more confident. But having those things, the yin and the yang, tightly linked together, that CIOs need to be vulnerable. They need to be confident and humble. But they need to be able to work with their team in a way that shows their team they're human, that they need help, that they need their insights. I need your insights. Your insights make me better. Your insights make the team better. You two need to get along because both of you are really smart and you need to find a way to leverage each other's talents and make each other better because you typically, I guarantee it, you will.
All right. Having been in the role for many, many years, yep. Going back to that, you know, sitting at your desk a couple of rows in from that CIO,
yeah,
you know, and thinking, oh, God, I'd never want to be a CIO, right? What do you think about the job now? What's your feeling now, you know, given you've been in the role and, you know, you've had some experience and you've done it your way, right?
Right. You know, it's a fantastic question. And it's everything I thought it would be and more. So when I went, what do you want to do when you grow up when you're in college, right? I'm like, I don't know. Computer programming came easy and that's why I did it, right? Honestly, I wanted to be an engineer. It was miserable. I failed. I couldn't do it. I'm like, well, now what am I going to do? Computer science came easy, so I'm going to do that. But I didn't like the pure play computer side of it, right? And I said, I want to be that person that sits between business and technology and is kind of an interpreter and figures out. That's I swear to God, that's how I started back while I was still in college. And then I realized there's actual value in that. And it's more than an interpreter. It kind of sets the stage for what we've just talked about. And so every experience I've had has been that and more, but it's in that context of sitting between business and technology. I love that. I just love it. I love that being able to build relationships and trust and solve big problems that change the trajectory of your company. What other role could you have where you can do that? And you touch every area, every function, right? Nowhere, in my opinion, can you have that type of influence as a functional lead, if you think about it, right? So I think the role is fantastic. Yeah, it's hard at times. And yeah, you know, uptime. I got someone doing something dumb and being a knucklehead and it caused a problem. I always say, look, don't shake the beehive and hand it to me. That doesn't help me, right? I don't need people shaking the beehive. And that happens a lot, right? And it causes you stress. And I know why the guy drinks out of the Pepto-Bismol bottle. I get it. But you don't need to create that where it's a daily occurrence, right? And it's so rewarding. It's so rewarding. And then there's times where your style, Brian said you did it your way, right? I've been very, very clear about what my priorities are with you guys, how I've done things. And, you know, it's not just about cost. It's about other things. Sometimes that's not the priority of the company. Remember I said the company changes a lot?
Yeah.
It depending on what's going on in the marketplace. And sometimes you don't fit. Sometimes your style doesn't work. And that's okay. It really is. You need to be confident to know you did it the right way for the right reason with the right people. And when it comes time to leave, for whatever reason, it has very little to do with what you did. It has a lot more to do with where the company's going. Maybe it's changing. They're changing their priority. They need something different. But when you have your people reach out, you know, just connect with you and send you cards and check in on you. And when you have other business leaders in the company call you, check in on you, how you doing? And I'm talking the old guard, the new guard, across all the functions, across my team. There is nothing more rewarding than that. In a bad situation, there is nothing more rewarding. And that's, so you ask me how the job is, because of that, I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's fantastic. And it goes back to people, right?
Yeah.
And connection and relationship, which is how we started this podcast. And that's what differentiates what I would call tier one CIOs and CIOs who are just focused on cost and service level.
It's a great way to put it. I mean, it's respect too. I mean, to have those folks reaching out to you, you built strong relationships, and I would guess you gain their respect, which is, I mean, in business, right? Those are the things you strive for. I think most people do.
And I love those guys. I love that team. I love my team. I love the people I worked with, right? When I hear from them, it makes my day, right? It's just a fantastic experience, and it's incredibly rewarding beyond compensation, beyond title, beyond resume, you know, because look, when you're sitting, whatever the time frame is, and you're kind of doing an assessment of your life, you're not thinking about, you know, what business problem did I solve? What did I make? What title? You're thinking about the people that you care about and that cared about you. And, you know, this is a real quick tangent, but so important. When you're trying to build your network, right? If you're doing it with the sense of I'm building my network because I need to get something, you ain't going to be successful.
Right.
When you're building your network and you think about what can I contribute and how can we help each other, that's where it's at. And so let's say you're going to change jobs or you're going to look for something different. Reach out to the people you worked with 10 years ago. I guarantee it, they're going to pick up the phone and take your call. Oh, I loved working because I loved working. Oh, you're great. You know, that network, that matters. But if you are selfish or out for yourself, they're not going to call you back.
Yeah.
But most of us aren't that way. And so that's the reward. That really is the reward.
Well, great. Well, hey, I can't thank you enough.
Sure.
For coming in and sharing your thoughts today. It's been really good, Brian. Thank you, too. Appreciate it.
Thanks. And nice to be included.
Thank yes, you. You're welcome. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. We will catch you on our next podcast, which should be coming out very soon. Thank you.